Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Last night's storms blew away a lot of spring blooms, and at least in my yard, the wind made it clear that some of our trees had some distinct architectural problems. In a few minutes, Iowa State University Extension horticulture expert Richard Giron and DNR forester Mark Vitosh will be here to answer your questions and to do some troubleshooting if you have storm damage. But first, we're going to talk about slugs. Donald Lewis is a professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Slugs are not insects, but what you might not know about Donald is that he also has an extensive hosta collection and therefore a long-term relationship with slugs. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for being here today. And first of all, what are slugs?
Well, slugs are a distinct group of animals. Their closest relatives are the snails. And if you recognize what a snail is, and then you took off that hard shell off the top, you would have the body that's left over, and that would be a slug. So one definition of slug is just a shellless snail.
All right. So, and slugs show up just about this time of year. Where are they appearing from?
Well, they have spent the winter under leaf litter, under debris, under the grass clippings, under the mulch, whatever is in the environment where they live. They always live in damp locations. When you see them, you realize there's not a lot of protection there from the elements. And so they stay hidden during the daytime. They live in damp locations. They come out at night when the humidities are higher, another way to preserve water. And then they feed on the foliage or the flowers or the fruits. But they have spent the winter in the adult stage, hiding in those protected locations with the coming of warm weather, with the coming of springtime and lush growth. They are ready to lay their eggs and begin the cycle anew with more slugs that will grow and develop through the summer.
So if you had slugs last year, you're going to have slugs this year.
Yes, the winter was not severe enough to have eliminated the slug population. They were protected under the mulch and the grass clippings, and then they were protected under the blanket of snow. So they came through the winter just fine. They've had plenty of moisture, at least here in central Iowa, this spring.
For sure.
So they have done very well, and they're getting ready to reproduce and blossom into a much bigger population than what we have right now.
And they don't look like travelers, but obviously every year people get slugs for the first time, so they must be able to move around pretty well.
They can move, and they probably get a little help from other critters that may have walked through their area, maybe picked up some eggs, maybe some birds or something, some other insects, help them get around for short distances. But we probably do some movement as well as we buy plants, as we transport mulch, as we have other items that we move in and out of the gardens. We probably help them. But I think slugs are already almost everywhere. If the environment is favorable, they're going to do well. If the environment is not favorable, then that if you have a hot, dry garden, you may not have as many as the rest of us. But given the right population, given the right conditions, the populations can bloom and then you'll notice them.
All right, and nobody in Iowa has a hot, dry garden this year. So.
Not yet.
Right.
We have in the past and we probably will again, just not right now.
Now, you mentioned they eat a number of different things. I mentioned hostas, which seems to be one of their favorites. But tell me a little bit about their diet.
They will feed on all kinds of plant material. They love succulent, soft tissue. So in the garden, the hosta leaves, especially those thinner leafed varieties or the varieties that have a big, thin, white edge to them, They will come up at night and they will chew on those, but they'll also crawl up on the petunia blooms and chew away on the petunias. In no-till corn, they also come up and they feed on corn leaves. So they're not very picky. If it's green and succulent and they can scrape off the material and get it into their gullet, they will eat it.
You mentioned that they come out at night, so a lot of us probably don't even see the slugs in our garden. How do we know they're there?
You may find some slimy trails. Some of them, in order to walk across drier ground, will create a mucus upon which they can slide. And if you think about a snail crawling up the inside of the glass aquarium, you've seen how they sort of slide and glide forward. Well, slugs travel the same way. You may see their slimy little trails, but you'll probably notice the damage. And the damage will just be irregular holes, usually in the middle of the leaf. It's not like they start at the edge and chew in like a grasshopper would. Wherever they stop crawling, they'll just begin rasping away. So you get these irregular holes in the middle of the leaf would be your first symptom. And then you need to begin looking at the base of the plant, pull the foliage apart, pull the mulch back, and see if you can find the critter.
With that damage on plants, now obviously we don't like the way that it looks. Are they hurting the plants?
Probably not. I mean, we grow hostas and petunias because we love the way they look. And when something interferes with that beauty, we think of it as a problem. But the plant is still alive. The plant is still functioning. It's going to be all right. And by the end of the summer, we're often sick of looking at our gardens anyway. Things are drying up. That late summer damage may not be as important to us as it would be earlier in the season. But when a slug comes up out of the straw mulch and eats away half of your strawberry, that becomes an issue because they can feed on fruits and especially fleshy fruits like strawberries that are close to where they live. You'll see that damage where they have eaten away part of the strawberry and ruined what you wanted to eat.
Okay, but you mentioned corn plants. They're probably not damaging corn plants.
No, because the corn is growing so fast at that point that in those no-till situations where there's a lot of mulch on the top of the ground, there's a lot of ground cover, they may come up and feed on the leaves, but the plant is growing so fast that that damage is going to be incidental. Sweet corn growers may have a slightly different feel about that, but generally, we control slugs in those areas of in the horticultural production, either flowers, foliage plants, or vegetables.
All right, now let's talk about controlling slugs. How do you do it?
One of the things you can do is just tolerate them, realize they are part of nature. We could try to dry out the environment, and for some of us, that means less mulch. And if you can stay under 2 to 3 inches of mulch around the vegetables and around the foliage plants and so forth, that will help. Don't encourage them by giving them a great place to live. Pull that mulch back from the plants a little bit. Have slightly less mulch. Things like toads and snakes and lightning bug larvae feed on either slugs or their eggs. So if we encourage a diversity of wildlife and have more snakes in the garden, we might have fewer slugs. The time-honored tradition is to go out at night with your flashlight and look for slugs up on the plants and pick them up and throw them away. So you could do hand picking. You can also do trapping. There's a common technique where you bury a pie pan in the soil, level with the top. You put beer in the pie pan. I suggest you always use cheap beer. Don't use the good stuff. And the slugs that are crawling across the ground will be attracted to the smell of fermentation. They'll fall into the slug pit fall trap that you have made. They'll fall in, they'll die in the beer, but they die with a smile on their face.
Do we know why they're attracted to that smell of fermentation?
No, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I think it's just one of those odors that they might be able to detect at short range, at short distance. And of course, it could just be the moisture itself that is in there. But it doesn't have to be beer. You can use other liquids, especially if you add a little yeast to make it ferment. You can get them to fall in, but it's kind of a slow, laborious process. You'll also notice that as you pick up mulch and boards in your yard, there may be slugs underneath, so that's another way to hand pick. And finally, we do have baits. There are special molluscicides. Those would be pesticides specifically for slugs and snails that you can use in the garden to control the slugs and snails that are pests to you.
These conditions that you describe of, you know, cool, damp, lots of mulch, I mean, that sounds exactly like a collection of hostas. Is that why they're such a pest on hostas? Because hostas also like shady, damp conditions?
Yes, it's the exact same conditions for both the plant and the pest. The hostas require a lot of moisture. We put mulch on the ground to help conserve that moisture and to control weeds. We're creating an ideal condition for our plants, which is also an ideal condition for the slugs. I try to limit the amount of mulch. I try not to build it up too deeply. And there are some places where I know there are going to be slugs on certain varieties of hosta. And so I actually pull the mulch away from those places over winter to see if that will help reduce the slug population. But yes, it is a double-edged sword. You're doing what's best for the plant. Unfortunately, you're doing what's best for the slugs as well.
So how do you control them in your garden? What are your preferred methods?
A lot of hand picking. As I'm working around, when I find one, I save them and discard them later. I do go out at night occasionally just because it's great to be in the garden at night and to hear what's happening and to look for slugs at that time. There are some plants in some areas where I know there are going to be slugs, and so I do use a slug bait. There are two of those on the market. One of them is metaldehyde, which is a synthetic molluscicide. It's a synthetic chemical that is toxic to slugs and to other critters as well. So we recommend very careful use of metaldehyde bait. There's another bait that contains iron phosphate, which is actually organic, and so it could be used in organic gardens. Iron phosphate says it is non-toxic to mammals and wildlife and birds and other critters. But there are documented cases now of where it was toxic to dogs. So with both of these baits, we use them very judiciously, use the least amount of possible, put it just at the base of the plant where the slugs will interact with it. And I do use some of the iron phosphate bait on varieties that I know are going to have a slug problem later in the summer.
And do you use beer in your garden?
No, I have a better use for beer than to try to feed it to slugs.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Donald Lewis, a professor of entomology at Iowa State University, stepping outside the insect zone to talk about slugs today. Coming up in just a moment, Mark Vitosh will be here, DNR forester, and Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension horticulture expert. And you are welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And, of course, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Mark, I mean, I know we had storms across the state. I can just tell you about my yard this morning, and it looked like a war zone. We lost several huge limbs last night. Are you seeing damage so far this morning in the Iowa City area?
I am some. As you know, I ride my bike to work every morning, and so I had a little detour on the bike trail this morning, but the city does a great job. I know I go by about 6:30, and I know they were already getting their gear ready to get out on the trail and break things down. The obvious thing I saw on the damage is actually going through town. I go through a large part of town. I didn't see a ton of damage. I saw a lot of small branches here and there, not a lot of big stuff. But where I did see big stuff, usually even going by my bike, I could see weak spots. I could see areas of decay and stuff. So when you get these 30 to 50 to 60 mile an hour winds, that's when you have stuff that maybe has decay, broken branches and stuff like that. That's when those things tend to fail. And that's what usually happens in these conditions. And sometimes it could be the whole tree, especially if that decay spot is somewhere between the ground and up along the trunk until you get to the main branches. That's a key spot. If you have defects in those areas, you can get breakage. So these kind of storms kind of bring those problems out sometimes.
Absolutely. And I did a little tour of our acreage this morning, and our oak trees are fine, so I felt good about that. With the other branches, I mean, and one was a whole tree, we're just going to have to call somebody to help us out. But when you do have damage in your yard and you're making that assessment, what are you looking for? What do you need to know right away?
So, again, with these kind of storms, I would look at the trunks and stuff like that. If what's basically look at what's left. The one thing you always with these storms is if you lose more than 50% of the crown on a lot of tree species, you got to start really evaluating that tree to see, hey, do I want to keep this tree? But then when you look at what's left, look for major cracks and stuff up and down, or even horizontal cracks along branches. Maybe you have a big branch that comes over the house. Look to see if you can see any horizontal cracks along those branches. Look for those kinds of things. Look for snap branches. You know, to me, look for risk. Look for things that, you know, with what's left, are there things there that could hasn't quite failed yet but wants to fail, or new cracks that you didn't have before, and then get those evaluated, because those are kind of things that, oh, well, it didn't break this time, but something's starting to crack, and this is something that could be danger to the house. Now, if you have a tree that's out in the backyard and you lose a few branches here and you maybe have some cracks, you don't have targets. You know, those I don't get as concerned about. But if you have things close to the house, you may need to call an arborist to really get that tree looked over to see what's there. And then back to what's left, again, if you have that tree way back in the back and that tree means so much to you but only 35% of the crown's left, you know, maybe you clean it up and say, well, I know Mark said, well, it doesn't have a great chance, but if it means a lot to you, it's not hurting anything back there. But if it's close to the house and it has other risk, then you really need to look closer at those.
All right. It's not good news for my giant ash tree. I know that. Anyway, if you have questions about your yard, your garden, give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Let us get to the phones. Garrett is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Garrett.
Hi, guys. How's it going today?
Good. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I've got a relatively large tree at the front of our property on the street side. I don't think it's an ash tree because I've seen, you know, what the borer does, and the tree looks otherwise healthy. But at the base of the tree, it's almost as if these viney woody growths have kind of fused into the bark of the tree, if that makes any sense. And they grow, if you let them grow, they'll get 3 to 4 feet long. I always trim them down with my string trimmer, but I'm wondering if there's any way you can kill those vines without killing the tree, or is it kind of a lost cause?
So you actually think the vine is part of the tree? I mean, does it come from the ground, Garrett, or?
No, it's right into the tree, like it's fused into the tree almost. And, you know, there's probably 50 or 60 little shoots if you let them go. And it's been doing it for years. And so we always whack it back with the string trimmer. But if you let them go, they'll get 3 or 4 feet long.
Do they?
And they go about 3 feet up the bark of the tree.
Okay. Do they have leaves similar to the tree itself?
No, they're a little different. But they do grow greenish leaves. And I just wondered if you could you just take a hatchet and chop them off or something?
Here's what I would do,
Garrett. Or is there some product I can put on them?
I would try to get some pictures sent either to Richard or myself and let us take a look at them, because it's the first thing I think both Richard and I are thinking is it could be some type of basal sprout, depending on the species of the tree and stuff. And on some species, like basswood or linden, you'll get a lot of trunk sprouts that can be kind of close to the tree that will come up, you know, or even crab apples and stuff like that. So it's just kind of, you know, most vines, I don't know of any vine that actually grafts into the tree itself. So it sounds like it could be some type of sprout from the plant itself. Richard, do you want to give him an email and then you and I can work on that? Or
it's Hortline, Hortline, at iastate.edu.
Okay.
We like those mysteries, Garrett.
Yeah, all right.
We like to try to figure those things out.
Yeah, thanks for bringing a challenge to the table.
In general, though, Mark, you don't use a hatchet on a tree very often, do you?
No, sir. Okay. No, sir. So, again, depending on what it is, we might use a small handsaw or something like that. There's these nice little folding saws if you need to cut something back carefully. I wouldn't even use a chainsaw. Anything that could eventually cut into the trunk of the tree, you kind of want to avoid.
Okay.
Thank you, Donald.
Good rule of thumb. Randy is up next in Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. I've got three questions. One, I've got a shag bark hickory, and I'm wondering who or where I would find the tool to do a core sample on the tree to see whether it's rotten or not, because it's too close to the house. If it fell, it'd fall on the west side of the house and make a heck of a mess out of it. The other question is, I've got oak trees and elm trees that are growing in kind of a clump, and they're probably 30 years old. One of the elm trees wasn't as big that it aimed toward the north, and it died this spring. Is that going to affect the other elm tree?
So I'll start with
two oak trees.
I'll start with the shagbark hickory. What you could use, actually, if you just have a longer drill bit, Randy, you can use just a drill bit and to check your decay, because what will happen is that wood, as you enter, it should consistently go in. If it punches on you, then you know you're into the decay layer. That's one way, and as that wood comes out, a lot of times if you have decay, that'll be discolored. So you can use that on how far you go in to kind of measure what your decay area is. You also, there's a number of certified International Society of Arboriculture certified arborists in the Iowa City, Iowa County area that, you know, they can look at those too and really try to help you figure out if that tree is a risk or not. But if you want to do it yourself, you can use a drill bit if you can get one long enough. I would use that
over a wood drill bit.
A wood drill bit, he asked?
Yeah. Yeah, just a wood drill bit, smaller one, but just dip it in there. And, again, look at the color of the wood as it comes out. But a lot of times just feel the tension, because if you're getting a decay, it'll punch through. As far as your clump of elm, we do have Dutch elm disease, but usually when they decline, they'll show the Dutch elm disease in the June-July period. But you may have had a tree that was showing it late summer and you just didn't know it, and then it hasn't leafed out. If it is Dutch elm disease and you have other elms close in that clump, they can often root graft. So a lot of times it will move from one tree to the next. And in a clump like that, there's not much you can do. Sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes they don't truly graft, even though they're really close. So the biggest thing would be to watch. And if it's going to get Dutch elm disease, again, when we have wet weather like this, it seems to come earlier usually. So I would start looking about mid-June through July and August, and the leaves will kind of start turning yellow. They may wilt and start falling off. That's usually a pretty good sign of Dutch elm disease on the elms.
I've got some dark plum trees that come up from the parent plant, and they usually get about as big around as your thumb. Didn't have any last year. With bad winter we had this year, is that going to affect the production again?
You want to handle that one, Richard?
I wouldn't think so. They're native to the area if you have a wild plum, and they can usually handle that. I'd be more concerned about some of the cultivated plums and cherries and other fruit trees.
All right, Randy, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go next to Pat on the line in Ames. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Yes, I have a hard maple that's planted in the parking along the street. It's only about 8 years old. It's never particularly thrived because we have hard clay soil, but we've taken exceptionally good care of it. It just hasn't grown as well as it should. Now, this spring, it's loaded with maple seeds. I cut a bunch of them off as much as I could reach because I thought they might be starving the tree. And should I be concerned about losing this tree? Thank you.
I wouldn't pull them off. I mean, that's what happens. A lot of times if you have stress from the year before, you'll get a lot of flower production and you'll get a lot of seed production. Since that tree is actually between the street and the sidewalk, you have a new city arborist. His name is Paul Tauke. I would actually give his office a call and have him come look at the tree. But anytime you get heavy seed production, you see it on the conifers and stuff, sometimes that can be an indication that that tree is under some stress, but it's not always an end, but it is for something to look at. And then you can start looking at the growth on the branches. They should be coming out in the next couple weeks. And if you get 6 to 12 inches of growth, you know, on a tree that's been there for a while, that's actually for sugar maple, 6 to 12 inches, 8 to 12 inches isn't too bad. So I would start looking at the growth, too. But if you really want to evaluate it, since it's between the street and the sidewalk, I'd call the city arborist and just see if he can come by and take a look and see what's going on.
And between the street and the sidewalk, does that tend to be a stressful place for trees?
It does, because a lot of times you've got cement on both sides. Tree roots, we know, are in the top 6 to 24 inches. And I've actually seen where they've taken streets out, and you do, there's a layer just underneath the cement that usually there's enough moisture and a little oxygen. You will find a few tree roots in there, but then you got the sidewalk on the other side. So it's kind of like a box with openings on each end, because if it's a long street, you've got that green area, but it does reduce the area or the cubic foot area of soil. So it is a tougher environment, and depending on how wide, I laugh because Garrett up in Dubuque, some of their right-of-ways up there are like 3 feet, and they have trees in there, and that's really tough. But I know in Ames, some of those might be that green area, maybe 10 feet, and that's pretty good for trees. So it depends how narrow or how wide that area is.
All right. Back to the phones. William on the line in Winterset. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes. Is there an organic product that will kill asparagus beetles? And if not, what's the next best option?
Asparagus beetles are not a big problem for most of us, and it kind of depends on whether it's the common asparagus beetle or the spotted asparagus beetle. Organic treatments, well, hand picking came to mind, but treating the spears where the larvae are feeding early in the season, you know, I might try spinosad, which is considered organic by most people, because they are out in the open. Insecticidal soap might actually do it if you can hit them directly. But as far as a bigger area where you might not be able to direct the spray in all directions to hit all sides of the plant, I'm not coming up with a good choice that would be organic, but spinosad and insecticidal soap. I might try Surround. It's the kale and clay product. But again, I'm not terribly optimistic, but those would be my first choices.
All right, and you mentioned picking first. I mean, is that, you think, your best
well,
shot?
It's always a cheap alternative, and asparagus beetles, the larvae often feed on the spears early, and so as you're going along, you say, oh, here's a spear that's been gnawed upon, and you throw that one away. So tolerating the damage by enjoying the rest of it and throwing away the damaged one is also an option.
All right, and if you throw away the damaged one, do you need to get it far away from your asparagus to make sure it's not going to infect the others?
Oh, as you've heard me say, we are not in charge. the beetles will get to where they need to be, and so the difference between throwing it 10 feet and throwing it 25 feet is pretty insignificant to the flight of a beetle.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, William. Let's do a couple email questions. This one is from Peter. He says, although I'm an Iowan at heart, I live right now in West Lafayette, Indiana. My wife and I are trying our luck with growing our own vegetables this year, tomatoes, peppers, sweet corn, lettuce, etc. We have rented out 2 community garden plots that are each 4 by 16 feet. My wife noticed that we have a pest problem that includes spider mites, ants. We think it's Formica indianensis, mm-hmm. and a yet-to-be-identified bug that eats arugula but not lettuce. Do you have a recommended method for protecting our plants from these pests? We would prefer to use more organic or natural methods if possible.
I believe a call to Purdue University is in order.
All right.
That Purdue has great horticulturists, some of whom we have trained. Getting local information might be useful. Number one, ants are not usually an issue. Ants are actually beneficial in the garden. Occasionally, there's enough digging that they may disrupt the rooting of transplants and so forth. But generally, we don't need to control ants in the home garden. Spider mites shouldn't be a problem this early in the season, so I'm wondering what they are seeing. Spider mites usually come in hot, dry weather, and insecticidal soap will take care of those.
All right, so Purdue Extension is the place to turn to?
Give them a call.
All right, sounds like a plan. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, Mark Vitosh, a forester with the Department of Natural Resources, and entomologist Donald Lewis. They are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's fit in a couple more email questions here. This one's from Ron in Des Moines. He wants to know if you can give him some advice on how to help a flower and vegetable garden recover from last night's storm and hail damage in the Des Moines area. He says, we have extensive flower beds with new flower plants and approximately 100 established hostas. I also had just moved about 30 pots of established coleus outside. The hostas are almost all shredded beyond recognition and look as if a mower had run them over. The other flowers are also badly damaged. Is there anything that can be done to help these plants recover?
Well, I think I'd be inclined to wait a few days and then assess the situation. Some of those you may have to cut back, and they'll come back if you do that. So if you have to, you can cut back the hostas. They'll send up additional foliage later on in the spring and summer, so they'll come back. Other leaves that maybe have been partially damaged, I would leave, even though they're not picture perfect, just leave them, because they do supply food to the plant. You might fertilize lightly. That would help. You could just use like a 10-10-10 or a water-soluble fertilizer. Give them a little bit of fertilizer, and then just see how they do.
All right. Here's a question from Suzanne in Redland. I have a question about tulips. I heard that once they're done blooming for the spring, many people dig up their tulip bulbs and replant them again in the fall. My question is, what do they do with them once they dig them up? Do they put something on them to feed them over the months?
They actually discard them is what they do. At your public gardens, here at Ryman Gardens, for example, if you go to Pella, they basically want perfection. And they want everything to bloom perfectly. So what they do
and
is...
And match.
And match perfectly, yes. They want perfection. So what they do is they basically enjoy the blooms, and then when they're done blooming, they dig them up and discard them. Now, the typical homeowner wouldn't do that. They'll typically bloom for maybe 3, 4, or 5 years. But eventually they do weaken to the point where they no longer bloom, at which point you dig them up and discard them. What you want to do, though, after they're done blooming is to snap off the actual flower head, because otherwise they'll form a fairly large seed pod, which weakens the bulb. Allow the foliage to die back naturally, and they should bloom for a few years.
And it's been such a good spring for tulips.
It has.
Just beautiful.
They lasted a long time.
Yeah, yesterday's heat may have pushed past the point, but it's been lovely and lovely for all those flowering trees. They just stuck around so long this year.
Much longer than normal.
Yes.
Dr. Isles was very happy with his crab apples.
I'm sure he was, and rightly so. Here's a question on the subject of slugs from Paul. He says, I have used beer in the past, but does this end up attracting more slugs like the Asian beetle traps?
The Japanese beetle traps, sure. No, slugs don't have a long-range detection method, and they don't have long-range transport. The thing about Japanese beetles is they can fly, and there are estimates of 5 to 15 miles that Japanese beetles may fly in the course of their adult lifespan over about a month. But slugs are very, well, shall we use the word, they are sluggards. they travel very slowly, and so you're not going to attract them from any distance away.
All right. So and until slugs sprout wings,
we don't have to worry about that.
All right. Good. Next up, let's go to Judy in Des Moines. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have two questions. I'd like to know what kind of rhubarb plant you recommend planting. And also, I have a bay leaf plant that I keep inside during the winter, and I've had it for like 4 or 5 years. It's getting large and difficult for me to transport. Is there a way to take cuttings off of that?
As far as the rhubarb, I would just see what you can find locally. There are a number of varieties that have a very dark red stem, and then there's one, Victoria, which has a green stalk. So most people prefer the red.
Yes.
All right, and then bay leaf plants? What do you think?
Well, that's mainly a house plant. It does better as a house plant.
I move it out every year, and it does really well.
Right.
I move it out early and bring it out in, and it grows significantly.
Right. Indoors, basically, make sure it has plenty of light. The indoor environment is just not very favorable. It tends to be kind of dry indoors. We have short days. They don't get much light, and it's kind of a difficult environment. So try to provide the best conditions that you can. Now, some people will basically, if they have a porch, they'll bring the plant to the porch first where the level of light is less, and then eventually bring it inside in the fall. So that's more a gradual change as far as the lighting conditions.
Judy, you want to know how to take cuttings and sprout a smaller plant? Was that it?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
As far as cuttings, I guess I would take some softwood cuttings, nothing big, maybe 4 to 6 inches in length, pinch off the lower leaves, and try to root them in either perlite or coarse sand.
All right. Judy, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Randy in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Randy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah. It's actually a question for Don. I had a run-in with a parasite here recently that literally crawled out of a mouse that I'd caught in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up parasites, and what it seemed to resemble was something called a botfly.
Yes, that happens.
Can you enlighten myself and the rest of the listeners as to these things? I'd never even heard of them or seen them before.
All right, so a brief history of the botfly.
Very few of us actually are fortunate enough to witness this ourselves. We usually have to read about it online. What you're talking about that came out of the mouse should have been about an inch in length and maybe half an inch in diameter, tapered at both ends. It's a legless grub that lived inside the mouse body. Rodent bots are related to the cattle warble or the cattle bot. So those of us who grew up on farms remember the bots that would be on the backs of the cattle, and it's a big grub that lives in the flesh and then would make this air hole, and we would pop them out because we thought that was great fun. But the rodent bot is a fly.
That was before YouTube.
Oh, yeah, we had to make our own entertainment. The rodent bot is a fly, and the fly lays her eggs on various animals. They will be in the necks of cats, they will be on rabbits, and they will be on rats and mice. The name is Cutorebra, and Cutorebra is the genus, and then there's a lot of different species under that. But the fly lays eggs. The eggs develop in the flesh of the animal, and when the bot has fully grown, they will fall out, go into the soil to pupate, and repeat the process. We think the mouse dies in the process, but maybe not. And especially with rats and with cats and rabbits, this is just a parasite, a lumpy parasite inside the folds of the skin of their neck that comes out, and they go on with their life just fine.
All right. Well, that was thoroughly disgusting. Thank you.
It was.
All right.
And when you have more time, we'll tell you about the species that infests humans if you move to the tropics.
Okay, next time. let's do a couple oak tree questions. This one's from Cheryl in Coralville. I have a 15-year-old heritage oak tree that suffered a crack in the trunk during last night's windstorm. It extends from where the first branches begin and all the way to the ground. The crack is not pulled apart. In fact, the only reason I noticed is that I saw a foam bubbling at the base of the trunk. Now what? And she has a couple of questions specifically. How do I keep insects from entering the crack and carrying oak wilt disease to the tree? Or also, do I need to hire an arborist to determine the viability of keeping the tree?
Actually, I just got an email from Cheryl, too. Oh. So I'm going to handle that one. But just to answer the question in general, if someone has some exposed wood and they're concerned about oak wilt, they could, if it ever stops raining in the next day or so, which it's not really supposed to. But she can take some latex paint, a light color, and just spray on that wound a little bit, which will make it less attractive to the beetles that actually can carry that fungus. Other than that, there's not much. You don't want to put any tar or anything on that. But if you have an open wound or if you have a branch on an oak tree that you can reach, if it's, you know, higher up in the tree, usually if the beetle's going to get there, they get there within usually the first 48 hours. So if you can't get to it, it is what it is.
Don't risk your neck.
I wouldn't risk myself. But if it's something you can reach and you can put a little bit of latex paint on there, I would. With the cracks, a lot of it is going to depend on the structure of the tree and stuff. But a lot of times vertical cracks, if they're deep, is usually not good to the overall survival of that tree. They'll survive, but their overall structure may not be good long term. So it kind of depends where it oriented and stuff.
All right.
It's hard to figure out on the radio.
Another oak question for you. This one's from Scott in Ames. And I realize we could do an hour on this because we have in the past. Any new research on oak tatters? How are things looking so far this spring across the state? He says, I can say my mature white oaks don't seem to be as severely afflicted this year. I see some leaves with symptoms, but not throughout the whole tree.
I watched this very closely, as you know. And so far, all the leaves that are coming out look really good. Mm-hmm. And I have not seen any symptoms or have had any reports. I have a lot of feelers out in the state, so if people start seeing it, they tend to send me emails and stuff, and I have not seen anything. As far as the research, we're kind of where we've been at all along. There's different evidence on different things, and there's been no exclusive research that has pinpointed the specific cause.
All right. With crops being behind schedule, I know that you think that there's possibly a connection between the herbicides that are sprayed on crops in Iowa and oak tatters. So is that in your mind right now, the fact that people are a little behind schedule on what they are spraying?
Yes, yes. And and we know if you listen to the crop reports as far as what's been in and stuff, they're I think a couple days behind, and the percents are behind. And so if there is a correlation to that, that actually could be a positive with the oak trees and stuff. If there's no spray there could be less. But again, we don't have a specific – we can't say it's caused by herbicides. We think that is a possibility. We've discussed that. There's a lot of other potential things too. So, but because of the weather, they've been in the field less. Mm-hmm. There is less spray. So okay. If there is a correlation that we would suspect, then we would have less damage.
So still watching and learning.
Still watching. But so far, so good.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Bob is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I head up a program, probably the only volunteer program in the state that treats the emerald ash borer problem here in Bettendorf. And I had a question for Mark. I have noticed this year, I've already treated about 180 ash trees with imidacloprid, that the trees are really leafing out late, the ash trees. I know it's a tough winter, but do ash trees respond at all to imidacloprid or eminec and benzoate, the two things you use to treat for emerald ash borer? By leafing out later?
I'll let Donald chime in at some point, too, but I have not seen a correlation with that, Bob. The one thing I have seen this spring, though, with ash is I think we have a pretty good dose of anthracnose coming. In the last 3 days, I've had multiple calls, and on my bike rides in the morning, the sidewalks are full of ash leaflets, and they're curled just at the edge of the leaflet, and there's usually a little black or brown. So I think we'll have quite a bit of defoliation going on, too, this time of year, especially we've had the weather conditions just perfect. I was riding the other day, and, I mean, there was literally a pile of ash leaflets on the sidewalk. So I think that could be correlated, too. Just in general, it could be the weather, but I've never seen a correlation between the use of insecticides. I know with some insecticides, depending on doses and stuff, there can be some toxicities, but I guess I've never seen a large correlation. Have you, Donald?
No, I'll chime in and say, Bob, the answer is no. The insecticide wouldn't be the cause of delayed leafing or the cause of the symptoms we're going to see from now on with the weather we've had.
All right, let's try to slip in one more call here. Barb in Mason City. Hi, Barb.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have lived in this house for 4 summers now, and there is a patch of lily of the valley in kind of the middle of the yard. It's probably 12 by 6 feet. And the more I try to get rid of it, the bigger it grows. I have transplanted some of it, but how do I get rid of it?
Well, there's basically two ways of doing it. It does spread by underground stems or rhizomes. And to effectively destroy it, you have to destroy all the rhizomes, all of it. If you leave bits and pieces, they reemerge from those bits and pieces, the fragments. So one option is to dig it up and very carefully remove all those bits and pieces as best you can and expect that you won't get them all. And then probably in a few weeks, you'll see some sprouts coming up. And do it again, dig it up and remove what you can find. You'll probably have to do that several times over maybe the summer. The other option is to use a herbicide like glyphosate or Roundup. Again, that will kill probably a portion of the root system, but not all of it. And when the new sprouts reemerge, spray again. But this basically requires, I think, patience and persistence. And so hopefully if you do that, you can get rid of it by the end of summer.
Okay, or learn to love Lily of the Valley.
Or just mow it off.
Right. All right. And we are out of time. Let's try to squeeze this one in from Kate in North Liberty. What's a good time to move ferns?
I would say very early in the spring, just as they're emerging.
Okay, so now?
A little bit late for that, but they could try, but it would have been like maybe around mid-April.
All right, and from Sharon, Donald, do walnuts ward off slugs?
No, I don't think they do, either as a tree, as a leaf mulch, or as nuts on the ground.
Okay, so bummer. We are out of time. Donald Lewis, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Mark Vitosh, thank you.
Thank you.
You're going to have a busy day with a lot of storm damage.
Yeah.
Shaping up.
Things are blowing up.
Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. We'll be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday on Talk of Iowa. And you never have to miss an episode of Talk of Iowa. Subscribe to our podcast. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, you can also listen online at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.